This is an interview with Michael Thomas Hill. It's taking place in Town Hall House in the city of Sydney. The project is the Art and Artists in Sydney Oral History Project. My name's Margot Beasley. The date is the 21st of December 2009. And Glenn Wallace, who works also for the City of Sydney, is also present. So if you hear a third voice on the interview, that's whose voice it is. I should mention that we introduce Michael as Michael Thomas Hill because there are many other Michael Hills. And so should anybody be listening to this and want to Google or do some kind of online search, it's best to look for Michael Thomas Hill. You'll have a better chance of finding the right one.
Yes.
So, Michael, would you mind telling me where and when you were born?
Born in Melbourne in 1962, but grew up in Sydney. My parents were just seconded to Melbourne for a couple of years, and then I came up here when I was two. So I grew up in the southern, western suburbs of Sydney, in the St George area.
So really you're a Sydney person.
Sydney person.
Mm. So we're here today to talk primarily about one particular work of art, but we're going to talk about that in the context of your other work as well, and your education and training and so on. And the one we're talking about is called Forgotten Songs.
Songs,
plural. And it is part of the Laneways by George project, which is a kind of annual project now in the City of Sydney, where public art is installed temporarily for a few months. And I guess the main idea behind that is that there is a general push here to revitalise the laneways. And one way of doing that is to make the laneways interesting and attractive and inviting places to walk through. Your work, Forgotten Songs, which I had a look at the other day, is this is putting in its most simplistic form, consists of a number of bird cages. They look almost as if they're suspended in the air. They're in the, I think it's actually called the Angel Place laneway, which is beside the City Recital Hall, and they're suspended quite high, and then there is bird song associated with them. So that's very simplistic. It might be best if you describe the project,
sure,
since you are the artist.
I think we wound up with 116 bird cages, different ones sourced from various places, mostly secondhand. We got a lot off eBay and went to secondhand stores, and my mother and sister and other relatives were all kind of out collecting and picking them up off the sides of the roads. So we got a collection of these cages, we then put in 10 of them. There are speakers, all weather speakers, playing back the sounds of bird songs. The bird songs come from files collected by a wildlife recordist, and they're all sourced through one of the ornithologists at the Australian Museum, Dr. Richard Major, who helped with kind of selecting the species of birds or bird song that we wanted for the project. He gave we approached him because we wanted to get just those birds that have been sort of forced out of the city by, you know, the growth of pavements and buildings and the loss of kind of native habitat, native vegetation. And so he was able to kind of look at existing species around the perimeter of the city and see where they still exist in the native bushland. And when we finally located our site, he worked out that it was kind of sandstone-based the ground is sandstone-based instead of shale-based. And that determines the type of vegetation that grows. Different, it's quite distinct, the sandstone vegetation as opposed to the shale vegetation, and as a result that kind of determines what birds tend to exist on the shale or the sandstone. So he was able to kind of sort out this list of species for us, and that's the kind of the underpinning of the project as well. The concept was about these birds that don't, you know, their songs aren't heard anymore in the city. So we wanted to kind of bring this sound into the city and make that an important part of the project.
It is very beautiful to listen to when you're there, and extremely evocative of the bush, which I suppose bird sound is. One of my questions when I was there, though, why there were so many sounds, but were some of them actually, I mean, you're talking about educated guesswork in a way about what species would have been here. I mean, very educated guesswork. It's not just random. It's a good, very good guess. But I also wondered whether maybe there were species there that may once have been recorded but actually don't exist anymore.
Well, all of these, there are quite a few species that don't exist and have been wiped out. You know, he bases a lot of his research on, Richard Major bases a lot of his research on the collection. There are a lot of skins in the Australian Museum collected over the 150 years of that particular organisation's life. And, you know, when they used to go out in hunting parties to far-flung places like Ashfield and, DY and come back with bird specimens. So they're reasonably well catalogued over the last 150 years, and there are species that sort of don't exist anymore. But the ones that we wanted were, well, I mean, we had to have sound recordings of them, and we can only get the sound recordings of ones that still exist. So there's probably songs that are, you know, lost forever.
I just thought perhaps, I mean, sometimes there are projects to preserve sound that was recorded decades ago. And I just thought perhaps some of that might have surfaced during the course of this, but obviously it's their extant species.
Yeah, I think it was kind of, we were bound by the, constraints of the project, where we were kind of had to do things in reasonably swift time. And if it was a longer kind of, longer form project where you had a bit more time, maybe we would have gone further into the archive and seen if there was anything around.
Mm.
But usually those sources are pretty, not as good quality as a lot of the field recordings done today.
Yes, I must say that's one of the noticeable things about it, is the quality of the recording in that space, and it's so surprising because I suppose there's a few pigeons living there and maybe the odd Indian miner, I don't know, but nothing much else. Would survive in there. I suppose you might get the old lost seagull or something, but nothing much else. But the that's one of the things that makes it so effective, is the quality of the sound, which that's why it replicates the bush, I suppose, because it sounds real.
Mm. Plus also you get this great echo in that space that really sounds like you're in a little, you know, valley or glade or somewhere. And, the sound bounces around so nicely. And for some reason, some of the sounds are reasonably badly recorded, or not badly recorded, but they do have a lot of hiss in them and a lot of noise that if you listen through headphones, you can't quite, you know, believe that it sounds so good when you play it out in public. So I think the a lot of the sound files are masked. You know, there's a lot of traffic noise in the background and hum and city noise and everything that masks a lot of the kind of tape noise, and the kind of high frequencies that the birds occupy within a dynamic range, you know, just cut through everything and, you know, sound so clear and bell-like in that space.
Mm. There's also a very strong, apart from the beauty of the audio, is there's a very strong visual aesthetic there, which is I suppose surprising, in the sense that if you said to people, well, there's a number of old bird cages hanging up there, it's not like there are some very elaborate cages around, but these are the basic budgie kind of cage that most Australians would be familiar with. But when you put all of them together, I've forgotten the number you said, 100 and...
About 120.
There is a surprisingly strong and cohesive aesthetic about the... I guess it's the vertical and parallel lines in the cages. I don't know how much you were able to anticipate that when you were...
Yeah, well, I suppose, I think we knew that the wire would always look good against the sky, you know, that it kind of always has a fineness or something to it that would look good. What's surprising, though, is the amount of kind of moiré effects you get when you put a lot of vertical lines next to other vertical lines, and they all kind of... vibrate or work with each other. It's a bit like, I'm not sure how to describe it orally, but it's it's like when one set of parallel lines overlaps another set of parallel lines and it starts to kind of activate it. Become active or dynamic.
It almost moves.
And so it was. When we started to collect the cages, it was a little bit surprising that I think there are legal widths now on, you know, you have to have... Some of the older cages we've got are quite large in the spacings between the bars. But a lot of the ones now, the legal ones that are able to be sold, have very fine wires, and, you know, I think that's just to protect the birds and make sure that the you can't have cages that are too too small for big birds. So a lot of the older ones we've got are kind of, you know, have big spacings. You can only ever fit a parrot in them, but they're massively small, that are really tiny when you think of a large parrot going inside them. And you can't quite believe them, but that's the way people used to keep them. So a lot of the times when we bought a lot of them, they said, you know, you can have it as long as you don't put a bird in it. Because I think there are restrictions on it. But a lot of the smaller ones, they're all kind of have this fine mesh, and when you hang them together, it kind of all, we were slightly surprised as well at how well all that came out.
I was also struck by the way that there is a kind of a contradiction in the whole setup. That is, you're hearing the bird sound of sound of birds in theory in their native habitat. I mean, we're within the building, but we're within the built environment, but they sound as if they're in open space. But of course the cages are a contradiction with the open space, the cages themselves. But they do make you think of birds, and I guess the emptiness of the cages is also another powerful image.
It's a suggestion of, you know, an enclosed space that's, and the emptiness is the thing that sort of suggests that they're gone. But I think that contradiction is the it's sort of the bit that keeps it alive, I think. I reckon if it was too obvious or too kind of straightforward, you know, people said, oh, you're going to put, you know, stuffed birds in them, or you're going to open all the cage doors, or you're going to, you know, all of these sorts of other suggestions to kind of make it a bit more literal. I think that if it was any more literal, it would sort of collapse.
Yeah, because, yes, you're probably right, because just as far as my own response is concerned, anyway, it leaves it with a little bit of a puzzle around it, which allows you to, I suppose, add your own interpretation, really, about what the cages mean.
Yeah.
Anyway... We've talked a lot about the actual work of art itself. In a little while, I'd like to talk about the other people who are involved with the project. But if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about how you came to have the idea for the project. I know artists are often irritated by the most common question that they get, which is, where do you get your ideas? And they often say, I'm not really sure. But I wonder if you can at least describe the process in some way about how it came about that you started to think about bird cages in the sky.
I think it really stems from the call for entries for the public art program, the By George program. It's kind of a funny thing that, you know, I feel like I am thinking things all the time, but in terms of bringing an idea to fruition, I don't really respond unless somebody kind of asks a direct question. So it's sort of, I have to put it down to that. And the theme that the curator, Stefan Lehmann, put forward was this one of sustainability. So we started to think a little bit about that. But I think My recent work over the last 15 years has not been as an artist, but it's been more of a kind of interpretive designer or a someone who works with museums and museum material, presenting concepts and sort of creating touchscreen projects and video installations, these sorts of things for museums. And so I kind of tend to think in that, it's caused me to think more in that interpretive way. So I think in terms of coming up with the idea, we've definitely had previous kind of interest or work with Richard Major from the Australian Museum about a number of his ornithological projects, and birds are a kind of long-standing interest of mine, and I've made video artworks and things previously using just caged birds and birds shot in zoos and things like this. So I don't know, my mind naturally kind of falls into those patterns. But also working with media, I think all my recent projects have been media based, and predominantly video projection or video art based. Trying to imagine that in a public space, in a public laneway, was a bit difficult, especially if we wanted it to have some sort of daytime life as well as nighttime life, plus all the problems of vandal proofing a projector and those sorts of things. So I started to think more about audio, but I'm not sure where the idea sprang from the bird cages, but it was definitely, I was thinking, something hanging. And then if I sort of trace it back, it was probably thinking about those fantastic pictures of Asian marketplaces and Asian sort of plazas and meeting places where people bring the birds that they have, their cage birds, they bring them down into the plaza and kind of all create this kind of communal cacophony of birds. So I suppose it's just, that image is the one that I wanted to kind of achieve, but I can't say where it all came together. But I think I had the birdcage image before we started to think about the interpretive side of it. But, the kind of what would you put with it? And then we started to think, obviously there's the sounds of birds, but how do you kind of organise them and what kinds of birds would they be? And that's when we start to think about the missing ones, and then the idea of having the kind of daytime birds and then the nighttime birds. So then it becomes a kind of a process of how do we settle on the birds? How do we find the sound files? How do we kind of roll this project out?
You've just mentioned there's something that we didn't mention earlier, but that is that the bird sound changes throughout the day.
Yes.
That's part of the work, isn't it? So at dusk and at dawn and at night time, the sounds will be different.
It's based on a sort of a clock timer, but it suddenly switches over to all the nighttime birds, all the tawny frog mouths and the owl nightjars and things. Mm. Just so that it has kind of a different life. And the idea of having birds twittering away at night kind of didn't sit right, so we had to work out a way of making it switch over to something, whether they all went silent or whether they went to the night birds was a point of point we had to develop.
Mm. So now, technologically, what's involved with making it all work?
We just run it off a single PowerPoint, but there's five MP3 players. One of them is a master, which has a clock scheduling it, and it plays out commands. It not only plays out its own stereo file, but it gives commands to the other four to play off at various times. So it's a 10-channel soundscape, 10 speakers running into five MP3 players. Plus we had to kind of put it in a weatherproof box because it's all externally mounted and the rain hits it. And we had to work with weatherproof speakers and kind of adjusting them to covering all the cables and making sure it's all weatherproof and can stand out there anything that gets thrown at it. Plus the other thing was just trying to hang everything in a way that when the wind comes pouring down Angel Place, so that the cages don't bash into each other and bash into the windows of the recital hall and all of that. So we had a lot of not only professional riggers rigging the whole thing with special cable, but engineering advice on, you know, how much weight each line can hang and how much wind tolerance and all of this sort of thing, so that it didn't damage any of the buildings around.
So all of the architecture of the work is all external to the buildings?
Yes.
There's nothing coming from inside any of the buildings?
No.
Everything is external to the buildings?
Just plugs into the external power point that was pre-existing.
Mm.
So, yeah, we were lucky enough that a couple of the previous artwork had already put in anchor points throughout Angel Place, so we were able to...
So those points were there from an earlier Laneways
project.
By George project.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's
helpful. That was handy.
Mm.
Otherwise, yeah, we might have blown our budget even more than we did.
I'm sure nobody's worrying about that now, but nobody works in plays except you. Because it's been a big success, hasn't it? It's very popular, and people are speaking very highly of it, and no wonder, you know, it looks and sounds fantastic. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the other people involved in the project, because you also have a business called Lightwell.
Yep.
And I think a couple of people from Lightwell, there was Richard Major from the Australian Museum,
yes.
He was the ornithologist,
yep.
And a couple of people from Lightwell also worked with you on
also
the project.
Also contributed, yeah. Dave Towie, he's the technical director at Lightwell. He organised all the MP3 players and the codes and the calendars and all of the programming that goes into making them work just on a power startup. So there's a bit involved in that. And Richard Wong, who originally came to us as an intern, and we got him started on this Laneways project just to have a give him something to do. And he developed up the network of cables and the hanging methods and all of this. So he was an environmental design student at College of Fine Art, and then completed his degree this year, and then he's been employed by us as well to continue doing this sort of work. So
that's a happy outcome.
But yeah, Richard Major, the ornithologist, he just teed up the sound files with Fred Van Gessel, the wildlife recordist, and Fred is I think he's about it. What has been described to me is being about 80 years old, and you know, still continues to travel around, Catherine Gorge and places, recording birds. But he's got a huge library of sound files from all over Australia and the rest of the world, and was able to give us these files for this project. But Richard Major spent quite a bit of time working up, because he was very particular and very concerned as well that. You know, he didn't want to put in any of the wrong birds, and knowing that the ornithological community, if they came along and heard the wrong bird there, they would be onto him.
Mm.
So, he was kind of very keen to get that right. It's kind of it's a little bit different from a project that we would do as Lightwell, because we tend to respond to creative briefs or respond to just more like a production brief from a museum, and this was the first kind of opportunity we've had where almost the reverse happened, where we kind of, I mean, ultimately the work itself could still be somewhere between art and, you know, what we would call an interpretive project or a piece of interpretive media, but it's it kind of stemmed from the idea first, and then it's almost like the interpretation happened second. So it's sort of slightly different to the way we normally work, but it's still kind of using a lot of the same production skills and project management and, you know, all that we tend to use.
But even within those four people, you are the artist as such, because the overall concept is yours,
yes.
And other people helped you to implement it.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
So... let's talk a bit about how your art education, you did, I think, originally do a degree in...
I've done it all.
You've done it all?
I did an art certificate at the National Art School, or now called the National Art School, then called East Sydney Tech, in painting, and then went to Sydney College of the Arts and did sculpture, performance and installation, which was kind of a very active branch at Sydney College in the early 80s, mid-80s. And then at College of Fine Art, I did my Masters of Art in Media Art. So I think it was that time that the Sydney College of the Arts kind of started to leave behind kind of fixed sculptural works and got more interested in performance and film. There wasn't a lot of video equipment around at that point, but Super 8, and there were some kind of low-band U-matic machines and cameras and things that you could use as well. So I started to get more interested in media art then. And then from that point on, started to make video art and video art installations. And when it came time to kind of get into the real world, I suppose I was making video art, but then got a job at the Australian Film Commission, funding and financing experimental media and animations, experimental animations, and then we suddenly got this vast wave of money from Paul Keating's Creative Nation Fund, and we had to work out ways of spending that in interactive and digital media works. So I had to kind of head up that program, kind of writing policy as to how that money should be spent.
For the film commission.
Projects. Yeah. Mm. So started to do that, and then after about 3 years of that, got more into, back into the production side again. But at that point, it was more websites and interactive media.
When you were doing your own artwork, you're really talking about the technical side of it, that you got into video art and so on, but what was the content about? What interested you? What did you want to say within that kind of media?
Well, I suppose there's... there's a number of different ways, that, especially at that time when people were kind of suddenly able to, with Super VHS and VHS cameras and camcorders and things like that, coming out of the Super 8 group, film group, where we were all able to kind of get our hands on shooting the images and making films and then presenting them. With video cameras, it suddenly meant that you could make long form pieces and you could actually keep them in a gallery or keep them sort of running for a lot longer than you could just a film loop in a through a Super 8 projector. But also at that time there was video art festivals where people would go to a cinema like the Chevelle and sit down and watch video art clip after clip after clip. There was a lot of single channel video work being made that was kind of like cheap cinema, I suppose. It was a way of showing stuff to people. It was before YouTube and before all of these fantastic distribution possibilities have arrived. So getting things out, making them was one thing. Like on a Super 8 camera, you could edit things together. But unless you had somebody with a projector in a projection room and audiences turning up, there's no way of kind of distributing it, getting it out. So video meant that at least you could kind of put it on a tape and send it to somebody or send it to different festivals and things. So in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of activity in that kind of world. So I was making, I suppose, personal, almost sort of video diary things with narration. A lot of still natural world kind of imagery, squids and jellyfish and, things that are set up in kind of water tanks at home and, light them strangely. So, heavily kind of still probably influenced by Bunuel and Chris Marker and, a number of kind of the early sort of, I suppose anyone who's doing things, short films in black and white, with kind of a little bit of unusual narration, I was there. There was a French documentary maker, Pan Levay, I think that's how you pronounce his name, who was kind of like a scientific filmmaker, but he crossed this border between... he was loved of the surrealists, but he was this sort of documentary maker who would make a film about seahorses, but this very kind of... subjective commentary. So I thought that was kind of fantastic and tried to do a bit of that sort of work. So, yeah, anything where it's kind of, you know, I suppose I started to make things with, there's one where I had a voiceover where I then filmed my eye lip-syncing it, sort of opening and closing and, you know, sort of lip-sync this whole voiceover. And other ones with, as I mentioned, sort of performance elements and things. So, you know, traditional kind of avant-garde student stuff that, you know, you're embarrassed by now.
But it sounds as though you always had a strong interest in the natural world,
yeah,
in one way or another.
Definitely.
And you did say also that you had had an interest in birds as well and had shot them quite a bit.
Yep.
Shot and
as in filmed.
So that sounds like that was a bit of a continuing theme.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say now that, you know, I've been a bird lover or you know, my life has been devoted to the natural world. But you look back and you see the work that I've developed, and it does tend to have those similar things. And it's kind of one of those things where it's a lot easier for the people outside to say, oh, yeah, that looks exactly like that, than your own viewpoint. It's very hard to kind of imagine... or very hard to see those tendencies in their own work. But, yeah, I'd say that there's always a continuing, you know, always a return to the natural world and filming the natural world. It's always a good starting point.
Well, and you wouldn't be alone amongst artists, would you?
No.
In fact, you could probably say it's the foundation of most art in one sense or another.
Yeah.
But of course, it's also a very happy fit with the work you do for museums,
yes,
which is what Lightwell primarily does. So perhaps we could just talk a little bit about some of those projects, which are not strictly speaking art, but must have a very strong aesthetic element in them.
Sure.
Most of them.
And I mean, it's true that a lot of projects are kind of natural history projects for museums, but mostly they're not. We do a lot on, you know, the Second World War for the War Memorial, or it might be Slim Dusty Centre at Kempsey next week, and, you know, the something else another time. So the Mary MacKillop Museum, for example, at North Sydney. So, but I kind of like the way that there's just this broad range of, you know, subjects that just come through the door. And you're not sure what's going to come through next. So, you know, my kind of attitude of sort of floating through life and kind of taking what comes works well within this, you know, this field, because people come to you rather than, or, you know, you still have to tender for work and all that sort of stuff. But you can never say, I'm just going to do this and just focus on this, because it just doesn't work out that way.
No. I suppose it's probably quite stimulating as well to be drawn into worlds that are not, like culturally, things that you're not particularly familiar with.
Totally.
I don't know if you're a Slim Dusty fan, but if you weren't, and then you're drawn into that, you have to start thinking about those places in a completely different way.
You do, and you also have to find the thing that is interesting in it, or else if you're working on a project for a year and a half, you don't survive. You know, you have to kind of get interested in it. And that's easier with some projects than others, but, you know, you always have to find that point of fascination with it in some way or another. But yeah, a lot of museum projects, or a lot of the natural history ones, are really fascinating for us, or for me, because they, you know, I'm working with content that I feel I'm familiar with, and I always like working with the scientists as well whenever there's an opportunity to kind of talk to them about the deeper things. But the recent work for the Australian Museum, we did a number of major projects for them for their recently reopened permanent exhibitions. One piece is a 6 metre long interactive touch table where we've gained together four projectors and project down onto this table, and you can interact with some of Australia's deadly creatures, so big funnel web projections and sharks and box jellyfish and these sorts of things. And, using this touch technique called machine vision, you can or computer vision, you can register where people's hands are, and they become the mouse. So it's almost like an interfaceless project. People can kind of put their fingers in the water, and a shark comes up and bites them, and then they give them first aid information about what to do if their hand's been bitten off, things like that. So that's kind of, that was a fun project, because not only is it like a big, it's a big communal table, and kids love it because they can all stand around and, you know, shoot with fear and horror, just with these virtual projections. But other things we've done are like a little bit more in the art realm, and if, you know, you were presenting it as art, people would say, yes, that's art, but here it is in a museum. We're on a big curved wall that's painted a dark blue. We got a whole series of fish and sea life from Sydney Harbour and rotoscoped them, cut them out frame by frame and put them against a black background, and then projected it with a water effect from a lighter, lighting projector. So combined video projection and lighting. But the fish cut out from its background sort of swims over the dark surface, and you know, it kind of looks, because it's projected onto this dark blue, it kind of looks murky and you're not quite sure, you know, how deep it is. And then combined with this lighting effect, it just sort of expands the, doesn't look like it's just a projection, it looks like it's, you know, part of a broader canvas. So you know, it's kind of a nice effect, but it's not really it's unusual for the museum in that it doesn't really have an educative value. It's just there for atmosphere and, you know, fun. Usually they like to have some sort of pedagogical imperative behind it, but that was one that just is there for pure atmospherics. So, but as these museums start to realise, you know, that keeping audiences entertained and stimulated, and we work with a lot of exhibition designers who kind of understand media a lot better now, and it's not just a simple touch screen in the corner, it's a whole range of elements from complex soundscapes to, you know, atmospheric pieces to large interactives to small detailed database-y projects, and it's this whole kind of range of media techniques that's kind of starting to be used a lot more, and it's kind of interesting for us that, you know, you have to start to imagine what way a particular story can be told in each of those types of, in each of those forms.
Are there many other companies doing that kind of work in Sydney?
There's maybe one other that does, maybe one other in Australia that specialises in just museums and visitor centres. And there's quite a few others that don't, you know, that do also event work and other kinds of projects for boardrooms and things. But yeah, we kind of just specialise in just doing this interpretive media.
I suppose you have also had to become a business person, having come out of an arts background and doing work that's primarily creative. There's that other complication in managing all those projects, large projects, and managing the funding and finance for them, that it can't have been easy to have learned that side of it.
No, not easy. And I've never really, you know, I mean, imagine myself sitting down and learning MYOB or these sorts of things, but it comes about as a result of, you know, small business. And, you know, the more employees you have, the more you have to worry about staff superannuation and these sorts of things, when really you'd like to be kind of developing concepts for artworks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of, and, you know, we're probably at that point, we've got four people in the office, and we're probably at that point where, you know, there's no one else around to do that except me, manage all the, you know, the tender writing and the and that kind of, you know, the business side of it. So it's yeah, it's I mean, for a while I got interested in it because it is, you know, part of the game, part of that entire sort of work, and I think it's kind of important to understand that money has to come in from somewhere, and not legalities, but that, you know, form or something. You have to kind of understand the exchange, and the exchange or the commercial exchange involved. And I start, the more I think about it, you know, the more I kind of like it, the business side of it.
Oh, that's interesting. Because a lot of people say they hate it.
Yeah. Well, you know, if somebody said, I'll take it away from you tomorrow, I'd be very happy, but I kind of don't mind it. And the more you, you know, my partner who is currently researching a book into the Renaissance, she said, you know, that's the way that all the studios used to be. You know, Leonardo Studio, they would always just do commissions, and they would, he was responsible for feeding six mouths, he said. And so, you know, you kind of have to work that way and have an understanding of the business.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was kind of that model of doing things for commission and doing things, or doing what you can within the bounds of commission. It's kind of interesting. You know, we think of these individual geniuses, but mostly they were kind of having to, you know, do the Birth of Apollo or something like that.
They weren't just jobbing artists.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Mm.
And they did what they could within, you know, the bounds of the brief and the budget. So it's kind of, you know, it's kind of instructive. But, you know, if I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd be quite happy in my studio just sort of tooling around. But I think it's... looking back over what might be my career, I've always responded better to requests, and I think I said that at the beginning, than kind of making art along the way. You know, I tend to sort of doodle and waste time and fritter away things. But, you know, it's probably good thinking time when I'm just by myself, but when given a commission or given a something to think about, it's almost like a design problem to think about. That's, you know, when I feel like I respond.
And that makes it happen.
Mm.
Your studio is in Surrey Hills, is that right?
Chippendale.
Or Chippendale, I beg your pardon. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that, because that's also within City of Sydney's local government area.
Yes.
Yeah, if we just...
And we're very happy with our new street curbing. Thank you.
Well, I don't think either Glenn or I was responsible for that, but we'll accept on behalf of the organisation.
Put in a good word.
Now, yes, just about the you saying that you've always worked better if you actually have, if a project is presented to you or you've got a deadline to work to or whatever. And when we talked on a previous occasion, you did talk about that a bit, that your own artistic practice sort of dwindled as you, I suppose, other work commitments took over, and you, you know, I guess had to earn a living and do all the things that other people have got to do, and the work that you're doing now is obviously extremely, you know, intellectually engaging. But something prompted you in this case to just make a piece of art opposed to a commission.
Yeah.
And I wondered if there were any particular circumstances around that that made that happen.
No, I suppose it's been a period of, you know, a few years where I feel like I need to think differently again, and it's a good way to kind of, or maybe I feel like that responding to the brief all the time is just quite a, you know, your brain might get ossified, or you think within certain parameters. You're thinking always of the budget, you're thinking always of, you know, time available, and thinking always of what the client might like, kind of thing. So yeah, perhaps that need for freedom, creative freedom, is kind of bursting forth a bit more. But I think also I feel like there's this new sort of area within, where, I mean, maybe I, when I first went to art school, I felt like, you know, there was not many careers available for professional artists, and even less than there are now, in terms of people earning money from their art. So probably in the back of my mind, I've always had this feeling that you can't really make money from your art practice. And, you know, I feel like now you can. There are artists around who can make money their art practice. But also there's interesting, you know, within the design world and within the art world, artists are sort of crossing over into design and designers are crossing over into art. There's a lot more kind of, you know, those sorts of divisions that might have existed before don't really exist anymore.
Because of the new media, you mean? Or?
I just think it's this sort of freedom of where artists are probably, maybe artists are becoming more professional and artists are also being respected as well, and so that they can contribute to you know, a design problem, or they might be involved in a public project, or there's a lot of examples of, you know, all sorts of artists working at a more professional level, not just coming in as the random sort of creative, but they're kind of coming in almost as a kind of uber designer, somebody with you know, ideas that maybe the designers haven't thought of yet.
Mm.
So there's these sorts of fields emerging, and where that crossover happens more. But also I think it happens because you know, you're just thinking of project-based work, where this project you might do this, and this project you might take on a slightly different role and be slightly more creative. This project might be just a small-scale project that's in a medium you haven't used before. I think I've started to think, instead of myself as an artist that does one thing, I'm somebody that does projects. And you do lots of, you know, you're running commercial projects and you're running, you know, other commercial projects that don't pay as much, but you're doing those because they're fun. And then other ones that just might be pure art and might be lost leaders because they keep you alive, you know, keep you mentally fresh, and then lead on to other things.
Mm.
So I like this sort of, you know, that's the new model I have in my brain of what I do, of kind of crossing this boundary between design and art. Maybe it was only in my mind, ever in my mind. But well, certainly, you know, when I went to art school, there was the design school, there was the art school, and there was no communication between the design school and the art school. And designers had already made their decision about, you know, they were going off to chase dollars and the artists were going off to, you know, stay true to their craft and be poor. And it's bizarre to think that that's...
It's very peculiar when looking back now, there just seems to be... The crossover is so obvious, but perhaps it has been encouraged by the ease of, I don't know, you were not really seeing it that way, but the ease with which people can move between different media now, including people who don't have any training.
Yes.
Who are not trained in anything at all can start to create art.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
And without ever having to develop painterly skills or draftsman skills, they can do things that are interesting and creative and worthwhile without having to worry about their own actual, you know, what we might call aptitude.
Yeah, yeah. I think it comes back to, you know, this sort of, not a focus, but the rise of the concept as the art form. You know, that when I went to East Sydney Tech, it was still quite focused on, you know, the quality of the brushstroke and the way of kind of applying paint that was your signature. But then at Sydney College of the Art, where I started came into contact with a lot more conceptual work, the focus there was not so much on, you know, your signature and your personality. It was based on the quality of the idea and, you know, your ability to kind of make it flesh. Although, you know, I think in recent times the quality of the idea has been raised to such a point where the making flesh and the making manifest is not as important. And I think it's kind of to art's detriment that, you know, you need to know the idea to understand the artwork. You should be able to kind of just appreciate the artwork on one level, and then when you hear the idea or the concept, appreciate it on another level. But I think, people who don't make their own artwork who kind of rely on experts to come in and hang bird cages and or do whatever they rely on. It's slightly is easier, you know, for them. They can kind of move from concept to concept and medium to medium, and you know, when designers are designing a toothbrush one day and a sports car the next, and these sorts of things. It feels like I don't know whether the process is any easier, so that they can, whether the tools make it easier for people to do that sort of thing, or whether all they've got with them is a website and a calling card, and you know, that's kind of what people want from you,
mm.
just to put the name on this kind of work, or maybe I'm not quite explaining what it is, but I feel like you know, what is it when somebody buys a Mark Newsom or you know, gets Mark Newsom to come in and design their chair for them? I suppose it's just his, you know, ability to look and solve that particular problem. But I'm getting lost.
No, I we don't have to go on along this stream much more. But I was really, I guess, what I was trying to say really is that the potential for people to create art has grown because of new media. Doesn't necessarily mean that art is terribly successful. And obviously, the kind of work that you do has an enormous amount of skill and experience and intellectual input in it. So, of course, ordinary people can't go and do that. But the sense, I think, I've had the sense myself anyway in recent years, the sense that people, young people, are not so intimidated by art as they used to be, because of the idea that you had to be so skilled at this or that, you couldn't, it wasn't okay to make a piece of animation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm not here to talk about what I think, but anyway, we're all getting a bit sort of complicated. What I really wanted to ask was, now that you have made this piece of art, unashamedly art, it's not a crossover thing really, are you interested in doing more? Do you think that will lead you back along that path, and do you have any thoughts now about
totally.
What you might do?
Yes, it's been a fantastic project for me, just to make something manifest and, you know, have people appreciate it, and kind of feel like, well, that's a project that, you know, feels like I've come back to doing what I was trained to do. Yes, I would like to do more of these sorts of things, but what has been really interesting is doing this in the kind of public realm, instead of doing something for a gallery or for a obscure German television channel. It has felt, you know, the kind of range of responses and the generosity of the responses has been so much different to, you know, work I used to put in museums. Work I used to put in galleries. And maybe that's because, you know, it's a better work than the stuff I used to make, but it's also just, I feel like people have been kind of, you know, coming across something in public space has been, is a different experience than that kind of mindset you bring to work in galleries. It feels, you know, like you stumble upon something unexpectedly, and it's a lot more of a fruitful sort of engagement. So the work I want to do in future is probably, you know, maybe work that's not in galleries, that might, you know, use a whole lot of other distribution channels, whether that's YouTube or public art or street art or whatever it is. But yeah, being kind of creating in those sorts of forums might be more interesting than trying to do stuff for galleries.
Mm. Well, I'm sure we're all looking forward to that, seeing what else you might develop over the over the next few years. There is one other thing I'd just like to mention. I know there is some talk of the your work in Angel Place possibly being made permanent. I don't know if there's been any developments on that at all. But the idea has been flagged.
The idea floated with the public art panel who would support the idea. So comes down to budget and approval, you know, for having what was a temporary project.
Right. So
permanently located there.
We'll see what happens, but one of the reasons for that idea being floated has, of course, been that such a positive response. And I think also we probably should mention that although Angel Place, when you walk through it now, is just a dark and rather gloomy laneway, with the exception of this beautiful piece of work up towards the sky, that there are actually also going to be tables and chairs outside opening up from one of the restaurants there, which will really add to the enlivening of the space and add value to the work of art as well, I think. I imagine that's what you're thinking. It'll be lovely to have people actually sitting in that space and socialising with one another rather than just walking through it and listening to the birds above. Mm. So let's keep our fingers crossed that the work is made permanent. Now, are there any other things that you would like to talk about, or you, Glenn, that we haven't? There may be some major points that we've missed that we should have talked about.
I wouldn't mind just asking, just things that you offered.
No, some.
Well, the Laneways program is, you know, an idea that's kind of been borrowed, if you like, from, you know, another city, town south.
Melbourne.
And in Melbourne, yeah, a very successful program over many years now. But cities do these sorts of public art projects from time to time, and they have ideas in mind about what they will achieve, you know, activating the lanes and those sorts of things. But I'm just wondering, from the artist's point of view, you know, how do you see, how does that sit with you as the artist, being, you know, kind of asked to do a job for the city in that regard? I wonder if you
I think you'd only respond if you felt like it was an equal exchange in the first place. You know, the budget of $25,000 was, you know, I mean, it was enough to kind of spark an interest, and, you know, it felt like that was generous enough to do something good. It eventually cost us about $26,000, but, you know, I think...
Over and above the original council's budget?
No, not over and above. So we only kind of, you know, cost about
what you put
$500
in.
Or something.
I see.
So, you know, the budget was fine. But so, you know, it felt like it wasn't so much doing a job, it felt like an opportunity.
Mm.
So, you know, that maybe other artists might have felt differently, but also you think, well, that's what art does, you know, is to draw attention to itself. So, you know, the fact that you're kind of drawing attention or drawing people into these places felt like a great opportunity rather than in any way onerous or, you know, against the aims of what art is intended to do.
Yeah.
So
sometimes it's seen as sort of instrumentalising art, you know, sort of putting it to an end that might not be the artist's intention.
Because you're using it to revitalise the laneway.
Yeah, you know, it's a kind of like, it's the most affordable thing that a city can do to activate before they do anything else. I mean, that's partly why we do it, is to draw attention to the lanes.
Mm.
It does get a lot of people there. They do see the potential of these spaces. So, you know, we are using it to everyone's benefit, we hope. You know,
yeah, but it's not like you're, you know, buying a painting and then hanging it in the laneway. It's, you know, you're getting people to address each laneway's specific.
Yes.
I think if you bought a sculpture and hung it, you know, out of the way, or, you know, mounted in an out of the way place, that would be a different intent. But because you're asking people to address all of the problems or all of the wonders of these laneways anyway, that's the task. You know, you feel like it's can be a good thing. And often the worse the space, the better the art.
That just raises one point. Were you allocated that laneway? How did it happen that your work was in Angel Place?
Originally, Philip Bridge Lane was going to suit us because of the, you know, architectural look, and there's a nice little sort of coffered part to the entrance off Bridge Street. But we didn't have any idea of how we were going to hang things in Bridge Lane, and I think, you know, putting anchor points and drilling holes in all those buildings around there might have upset a few people. The program, or the By George program, suggested we should shift to Angel Place. And the existing hanging points there made it certainly easier and probably kept us within budget as well.
Mm. So that was just a matter of practicality.
Yeah, yeah. We got a couple of, we made some additional sort of penetrations in the wall, but the owner there was kind of happy to allow that to happen to his building that he was going to pull apart anyway. So all that was fine. But yeah, and as it turns out, I mean, you know, everybody's commented on the appositeness of it being outside the recital hall and angels and all of these sorts of connections that people have made, you know, makes so much sense now. And yeah, I can't quite imagine it in the other place now in Bridge Lane.
Mm.
Sort of feel too cramped or something.
Mm. Did you have something else you wanted to say?
No.
No? That's Glenn I'm talking to?
Yeah,
no, you think that was just the one question you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think, no, the number of responses, going back to what Michael said, has been great. You know, we've got 8 projects in 8 laneways, and the diversity of responses has been what's been sort of, you know, thrilling for us at the CSC. You know, a lot of the projects contain ideas that can be explored further, you know, by different people, landscape architects, and, you know, seeing trees in some of the lanes, and there's a small bar in another lane. So there's all sorts of ideas that have come out that we wouldn't have imagined, which is good to show other people.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, what's possible, what art can bring to, you know, the city, you know, much more than what we could have preconceived,
mm.
you know, of what art was going to do. Yeah.
I think for myself, I would say, and I imagine this is probably fairly typical of most people who walk through those spaces, is the art makes you smile in a place where you would otherwise not do that.
Yeah.
It's a place that you're scurrying through normally to get to somewhere, and the art really makes you literally smile,
mm.
and which is a wonderful thing for it to do.
Mm.
It sort of, it transforms the space,
mm.
you know, it transforms people's experiences of the city,
yeah.
which is great. Yeah.
I think that's an excellent
yeah.
way to end.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Michael and Glenn.